Hi, welcome to Arcane Connection, which may be the first, I don't know, Ars Magica podcast. The story of this podcast is very simple. 25 minutes ago, me and Tom decided that we would make an Ars Magica podcast, and having gone to our local shop and bought a £3 microphone, we've now started to do it. So Arcane Connection may be probably the worst podcast in the world. Yep, it's brewed in the UK by Danes. Me and Tom are both half Danish. So, let's do the introductions. Hi, I'm CJ. I've written a little bit for Ars Magica over the years and been involved largely through things such as attempting to get new people to try the system and running the Grand Tribunal UK convention several times. And here's Tom.
Hello, I'm Tom. I haven't written anything for Ars Magica. I have done writing scenarios to play at conventions, so for Grand Tribunal UK, I've written some things, run some things, try to keep the convention goers happy, try to keep people exposed to a different bit side of ours.
And when Tom's exposing his ours, I like to think of him as mainly a forum guy, a guy with great ideas, who some of you may know from the Ars Magica forum on Atlas Games as Darkwing. What we're going to talk about today is why play Ars Magica, because there's an awful lot of role-playing games out there. And it just seemed like a fun thing, a fun topic to spend a few minutes just discussing about it. So why would you play Ars Magica? Well, the answer is, in my case, I didn't. I've been role-playing since 1979. I'm 43 now, so it's been a long time. And here we are in 2013. But I didn't actually come to Ars Magica until 1993, when a friend called Axel Johnston, a legendary rules lawyer and role-playing GM, now living in Canada, great guy, decided at university, look, why don't we give this a go? Why don't we try Ars Magica? And he was, like me, infused by a review he'd originally seen in Dragon, which I think described it as having possibly the best magic system ever designed, and that's certainly something I've seen many times since. So I actually first came to Ars Magica in 1993, by which time the game had quite a history. And the first thing that happened was I went to generate a character, discovered that you didn't roll three six-sided dice to generate your stats, looked at it, spent a couple of hours trying to get my head around the magic system, and gave up. And it was, another 6 years before I came back to Ars Magica. So, Tom, how did you first come to Ars Magica?
Well, in the 1990s at university, everyone was playing White Wolf games of some form or another. One of my friends was running Ars Magica in a huge game with lots of people playing. So, I don't know, 8 to 10 of us playing. So, and he was trying to do it as a troop style with 4 seasons. So, each season, one person playing a mage, everyone else would be playing a Grog or companion. In the end, we ended up having to have a huge mess of characters because 10 players, one GM, got kind of unruly. But I was exposed to 3rd edition and the joys of Reason and all the other White Wolf touches that made 3rd edition how it was. And then didn't pick it up again until 5th edition.
Right, but so we were both put off by our early experience with Ars Magica.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing there is you've mentioned troop style play, and that's a concept that, while it's still involved in the game, it's still part of the game, it's one that's been, I think, less important maybe in some ways in 5th edition and earlier, though the capacity is still there to do it. Troop play is, in Ars Magica, the game is set in the 13th century in a world of medieval wizards where there's an order called the Order of Hermes. And the Order of Hermes exists within mundane Europe, or mythic Europe, because there are dragons and giants. The legends are true. So it's a great setting for a game, because you can use lots of real history, but you can also use lots of real myth. And you can do loads of different things with the game. But primarily it's about magicians, and the magician characters are much more powerful than any other. There's none of this concept of game balance, so everybody in the game has a magician character. But they also have, well, can you explain what a companion is, Tom?
A companion is a character who has a reasonable level of power, can do all the mundane things a mage can, and there's a wide range of options of what they can do, but yeah, they're just designed to be companions to the magi characters.
So
they can do the things that they can.
Fairy, ladies, knights, hermits, beggars,
yes.
Thieves, any kind
priests.
Of normal character.
Yeah.
And in an ordinary session, the idea is that a couple of people maybe play the Magi,
yeah,
and a lot of people play the Companions. The noise in the background isn't me and Tom having a fight, it's the cats having a disagreement. So I'll just say hi to Hansina and Cuddles as they wander through.
Your black familiar does not seem happy tonight.
No.
That cat seems to be possessed by the devil.
That's because I forgot to feed him his bloody milk. The old jokes are the oldest. Anyway, back to the plot. So you've got Magi, and everybody has a Magi character, but they might not play it every session. And that's unusual in most role-playing games, where, you know, you play...
Same character, week in, week out.
But something else that I'd got quite into by the time I came to this, and we still got to discuss Grogs, but I'll come back to those in a moment, is I've been playing for about a decade a game called Pendragon, where the time scale does involve multiple characters, because eventually you play the children and grandchildren of your original characters, and you generate their wives, and, you know, it's a great game about Arthurian knights, which takes place over a 70-year period, and that was my... real first interest was the idea of running long-running campaigns with the same characters that saw them from beginning to end.
But with Pendragon, in contrast, you play knights. They're virtually all characters in the basic bit of Pendragon are knights.
Yeah.
If you develop on with the more complex bits of awesome Pendragons, then maybe you'll have some fighting men or squires, or maybe you'll have a token major or holy man as well. But in practice,
the chief characters are all knights. Whereas in this game, everyone plays a wizard, but there's also the companions which provide the other characters. So in a given session, Tom might be playing Darkwing, his magus, who's specialised in corpus magic?
Yes.
That's magic about bodies. And we might also have alongside Lucius, I'll use him as the obvious example, because he's a fire magician from House Flumbo, who specialises in fire magic, so he specialises in fire magic. And two might have with them a group of people, including a knight, a half-blooded giant, a hefty guy who throws things around, a hedge magician witch who cackles and hunts for herbs, a priest, and a runaway nun, a curious nun. You know, there's a huge amount of options for characters in the game. But the thing, the style of true play is not just about the fact that you've got two different characters that come in and out of play. I'm sure there are other games that do that. You've also got the grogs, who are guards, effectively. Sergeants that are servants. Any of the servants. And grogs and common folk. And those are the minor characters. And it's actually suggested that you just create a batch of them and that you just grab one you fancy playing for that session.
Yeah. Pulled characters.
So you might not even play the same grog each week, but they develop a personality and players, you know, portray them. It's like actors who are playing the bit parts in a soap opera, I guess. They might not play the same character each week. They might come on with a different wig, a different hairstyle. And to me, they're very much Shakespearean characters. I've just written an adventure that's been published in Sub Rosa, which is an Ars Magica magazine, called Love, Labour's Lost, in which the joke is it's a cross between the bawdier characters in Shakespeare,
all the exuberance of Chaucer with none of the concrete.
I can't even say it. None of the vulgarity. Sorry, I can't do the Cartots and Coronets quote because I can't say the word. But I'm better at spelling than talking, so I apologise when you're listening to this. But those characters, you know, they're bawdy, low, playful characters. They're not comedy characters, but they can be. So I took a Shakespearean theme, Love, Labour's Lost, chucked a bit of classical mythology, and then took an episode of Father Ted. Yes. Kicking Bishop Brennan up the arse. The adventure is called Love's Labour's Lost, or Kicking Darius of Lombard up the arse. And it's about the awful things that the grogs, the servants, get up to while the Magi are busy. So yeah, I mean, grogs are great fun to play. But there's also the Covenant. Do you want to explain why Covenants are so important?
So, the Covenant is the place where your Magi are based. So they'll have their own place where they live, where they study, the laboratories, the library, workshops to help them have whatever they need. But the style of your covenant determines a lot of the style of how you want to play.
Yeah.
So if you're in a big castle, clearly you're going to associate with nobles, and people around will think you must be associated with powerful warriors because you live in a big castle. If you're hiding out in a place in the city, there'll be stories of other city folk intruding on you, and you'll have trouble trying to hide your magic. So, whereas if you say have yours next to a monastery, you'll have to act in a more church-like way, and you have more church characters involved in your covenant.
So a covenant is just the place where the characters live, but it's also designed as a character in its own right, effectively, isn't it?
Well, it has virtues and flaws, same as a character.
And it's a bit similar in that way to, you know, if you play a long-running Traveller campaign where the characters have a starship, and it's the thing that binds the characters together is the starship, and their roles as crew. And in Nobilis, you've got the concept of a chancel, at least in the editions I'm familiar with, where the characters serve an imperator and work together in a common home, and they design that home. And in Ars Magica, you design the Covenant as a group. So you decide from the beginning, you have a story guide, a referee, a DM, but that story guide has less power and authority than in some games. But that means to say it's a lot like the modern indie games, does it? very different feel. I mean, it's not like Primetime Adventures where everything is up for grabs and that everyone starts off, you know, well, you know, what's the game going to be about? It's nothing like that at all. No. You actually have a very, very, very defined set of rules. I would say more complex in many ways than D&D.
But it's there to give you options as to how you want to set what's going to be the defining theme of the game, really.
Yeah, and what makes it an Ars Magic game are three things, I think, fundamentally. The three things that guide you into the game setting are, one, it's about wizards and their friends. The companions and grogs are defined by their relation to the wizards. You might not always play your wizard. Two, it takes place over a long period of time. A campaign might, I mean, some of my campaigns have run for 70 years. The one we're playing at the moment started in 1160 and went 1216. So, yeah. 56 years, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's a very long time in terms of an ordinary role-playing game. We've been playing for, what, 2 or 3 years, but it's quite a slow game. Some games might do that in 6 months or even a month. You know, it depends on how many years you want to pass between adventures.
Yes.
So the second thing that maybe that defines it, firstly, it's about wizards. Secondly, it's set in our real history, but with all the exciting stuff from the mythology of the time.
Yeah.
So you don't need a huge amount of background books, really, because you can just use real stories. You know, we've had adventures with Richard the Lionheart, King John. You've seen the various battles shaped English history. Did you? You didn't prevent the signing of the Magna Carta this way round. That was a major motif in my first game, Antiqua Natura. Was the Magi stopping the signing of the Magna Carta and the repercussions of that? But you know, over the years, we've seen a lot of messing around with real historical themes. And unlike Pendragon, where if you mess around with a metaplot, you really can, you know, cause problems for the game. If you were to kill Arthur in session 2, it would really change the nature of the game and it would stop being Pendragon.
Or if you're to go, here's the Holy Grail, I had it in my back pocket. But in Ars Magica, it just takes a slightly different turn and you just keep on, the world keeps going.
Turning. It keeps churning, but things change. I mean, in our game, King Richard lived significantly longer than in history, didn't he?
Yes.
And I'm trying to think of other things that happened. I mean, Eleanor of Aquitaine played a different role.
We stopped Constantinople getting sacked.
Oh, yeah, you stopped the Fourth Crusade sacking Constantinople, and in the current setting, the Byzantine Empire is still limping on.
Yes.
And you moved the Cathar population of Provence to the Balearic Islands, preventing the Albigensian Crusade.
Yes.
I mean, these are minor aspects of real history, but, you know, but the game is still going, and the world has changed, and the background is no longer quite as close as to that initially. And that's not actually a problem, is it?
No.
No. I mean, you take these things into account, the story goes. But another aspect of it is it's a long-running game where epic things can happen because, you know, I said at the first point was it's about magicians. Magicians are powerful. Even the starting level, what can a starting level character do? What's the most ridiculous thing you've seen a starting level character being able to do? I mean, we're not talking nobilis power
levels
here.
Well, the most ridiculous you can think of, it seems like people going, turn that person dead, or people going, oh, look, I'm able to create such a huge magic item if I spend the next year in a lab. But, you know, many starting characters at the start can change people's minds or do a reasonable illusion.
Talk to animals, turn invisible, or fly.
Or fire combat spells at people. Your starting character is reasonably competent. Give them a few more years, they can do quite a lot.
But they are.
Give them decades, and it's like, should I cast 1,000,000 spears at these people, or is just 100 as a warning shot enough?
Yeah. Should I cause the sky to rain javelins upon the army? That is what you can do eventually. Yeah, we've seen it in our campaign.
Yes.
Our saga is what we call them in Ars Magica. But, I mean, why you play Ars Magica, I think, is partly because it has a very bounded detail, certainly in 4th and 5th edition, not so much in the earlier editions, but now the rules are mechanically complicated and provide restrictions. And one of the important things there is, we'll get back to this question of law lawyers in a while, there's a lot to learn, but once you learn it, there's a very clear set of parameters for how magic works and what the limits are. But the third point I was going to go for is, in most games, I mean, in Pendragon, in this period between years, in the downtime between adventures, you roll for your childbirth, perhaps, you might manage your estates. Whereas in Ars Magica, you could happily spend a couple of hours, 10 minutes, or 3 days designing magic items, reworking your lab, and working up what your character does in those seasons when they're not actually on adventures.
Reading books, lab work.
And characters get better more. Not from adventuring, but from actually progressing.
From time passing,
what they're doing in the laboratory, what books they have access to, what magic items they're designing. So, yeah. So, I think that's the big difference in Ars Magica. If you enjoy character creation, then Ars Magica is a role-player's wet dream.
oh, you can create thousands, infinite number of characters.
But the character creation process never stops because you're using the resources available. And if the problem comes when, of course, you need a dragon, that you need a dragon's toenail or a piece of fine amber with a fly trapped in it, or a particular rare herb for a potion or spell, and the rules will demand you to, you know, if you want to get the levels you need, you'll probably need those things. Yeah. And then you're forced out of your laboratory and forced out of the downtime aspect of the game, the design part of the character, and you're sent off on adventures, stories. And usually, like, I mean, most RPGs, people get really bored if their character's not involved in the action and they have to play a secondary character, a grog or a companion in this case. But in Ars Magica, I've known people to say, oh no, no, I can't leave my lab. I'll send the half-witted grog, you know, the servant, the bodyguard, who's short-sighted and is covered in tin pans because he makes his living as a tinker when he's not bodyguarding me. I'll send him into town to carry out the burglary. So what if he clanks? At least he'll be able to steal the amulet I need. You know, I'm not leaving my lab. I'm only one season more and I've finished writing my great book on how to teach the magic of fire. So the three basic things we've mentioned so far in Ars Magica are, it's about wizards and it's got the best magic system in the world. Yeah, it's, I bet we'll talk about that in a moment briefly, but secondly, it's about a covenant and time passing and the characters getting better. And thirdly, the character design process never stops. You tell your character's whole life. I think that's true, don't you?
You do. Your character keeps going a long time.
Now, we always your time. You should always do lists in threes. And one of the things that you learn from watching Hitler's speeches is he always does things in threes. You know? So, one, I say to you role players, in future, when you come to my house, first, you will bring food. Second, you will bring drink. And three, you will obey the GM. You see, freeze. So let's have a fourth point, just to prove we're not actually, you know, disappearing off into the wild world of political rhetoric. What's the fourth thing Ars Magic is about? It's about magic and playing wizards. It's about the covenant and time passing and playing the whole length of the character's life. What's the third thing is that character creation never really stops. You're constantly developing and improving your character throughout the game, not by just spending experience points, but by, you know, do I make a longevity ritual? Do I take a potion? Do I manufacture a particular magic item? Do I learn a new spell? Do I teach somebody else? Do I go and collect raw magic, viz, or wis, as it's called, so that we can make more? You know, there's so many different options. It could just be, should I just decorate the Great Chamber or fix the leaking roof on the tower? Or shall I go and search out those fairies we met last season? All of those things are important. If we had a fourth thing, what would it be?
I'd say we wrote the scope, simply because maybe this will be finding the missing servant this week, or maybe this will be how I'm going to construct a tower that reaches to heaven.
I reckon it's about rules lawyers. Yeah?
That's only because of the people we play with.
But I said initially I was put off. I joke that my friend Axel, great role player, is a rules lawyer, and he is. He loves pedantic reading cases of rules. And one of the things that put me off, actually, was the fact that, obviously, the rules were just so incredibly open. There were so many possibilities. I've never seen a role-playing game like it. I'd come from a background of Traveller, Cthulhu, Pendragon, D&D. I'd played pretty much every system, I think, that was, you know, commonly available in UK game shops in the 80s. I'd played upwards of 60 or 70 RPGs by 93. But then things changed forever, because back in 99, a friend called Guy said, look, let's play Ars Magica. And I was, you know, I was put off, but he wanted me to referee it. And I said, well, okay. And I tried to read the rules in 4th edition. I mean, it's a great book, but I found it about as exciting to read as stereo instructions. 5th edition is much more readable. 4th edition actually is a great system, and it was available as a free download from Atlas. I don't know if it still is. Actually, I should mention at this point, this is a completely unofficial podcast, and we haven't asked permission from Atlas, so if they want to sue us, hello, John, hello, Michelle, we're really sorry. Moving back, though, and hoping that there aren't any legal problems with this podcast, let's move back to the question, which is, why do I say it's a game about rules lawyers? Well, once you get your head around the rules, the scope is incredible, and we play with some of the most fundamentally rules lawyerish role players I've ever met, don't we?
Yes.
And I'm a... Would you say I was more story now?
Yes, I'd say.
My style of role-playing is all about the story. It's about the characters. It's about the plot. I find ponderous, detailed. One of the things I love about RuneQuest is the background, which is why I now play HeroQuest, because I found that the older editions of RuneQuest, combat bogged down. It became very slow, very mechanical. And I'm not good at learning rules. And I mean, Axel would joke. I said he was a rules lawyer. He would say I was just stupid. Because I can't get my head around rule systems very well. So what happened was, with that new campaign under 4th edition, my friend Guy suggested we gave it a go. And actually, he knew the rules. And Kev read the rules and got his head around them. And even though we didn't know the rules, you know, I was able to play and I was able to story guide. And this is another aspect of troop style play, which we haven't really touched on, which is everybody gets a chance.
Yes.
So in our campaign, our saga, I think all the stories have been run by me or you so far, haven't they?
I think so.
I'm trying to think if anybody else has ever run a story.
No, people said they will, but then mysteriously you say, but I've got a great idea for what we're doing this week. And then we say, yes, Chris, you run.
No, you run quite a bit.
I've run a fair few, yeah. Yes.
But the story guide changes. So Tom ran stories about, well, I ran stories about medieval history mainly, didn't I,
yeah,
at the beginning? What were your stories about?
So one's about history to do with York, or history to do with...
We'd have to be careful here, because we've run a lot of playtest games and we can't talk about projects that are...
No, because we did one, say, set around history of York.
Yep,
one
that's
set
right.
Using myths of North Yorkshire.
Mm-hmm.
Couple of fairy stories, a couple of things to do with angels or creatures pretending to be gods, creatures pretending to be demons.
We haven't got no watch. Our campaign's set in York, isn't it, Elva Rosa, but we've travelled all over mythic Europe and
beyond.
And I've got a character, Oswald. He's generally considered to be the most irritating character, and he's a specialist in meta magic, which I think probably makes more sense if you're a Magic the Gathering player than most types of roleplaying. I cast spells that affect other spells, largely. And I'm an expert in magic theory, and my character's very good at working out, you know, what's going on. In fact, he shocked Tom in the very first adventure we played when he managed to find his way into a kind of pocket dimension using a spell.
You shouldn't be able to spontaneously cast that as a character that young.
But I did. One good roll. And that's one of the nice things. The dice roll system is quite cool. But rules learning, to get back to how we got into World of Magic, which we'll talk about again in a minute. Rules lawyering is one of the things. I mean, we have Kev and Luke and lots of people who are very fond of using the rules in power gaming. And not in a bad way, in a good way.
Yeah.
You know, playing for maximum advantage for their character, making rational decisions their characters would make to maximise their power, I guess. And they also, we have people, and I mean, they do also, though, I mean, take flaws which are story-bound and which lead them into adventures and counteract that completely. I mean, you can see a lot of that in Kev's characters, actually. That they get involved in stories, and Luke does it as well. They get involved in stories that are about story, not about mini-maxing their power. But rules learning is certainly something you get a lot of in our role-playing game group. And one of my other favourite systems is HeroQuest 2, which is a fantastic game. It's a generic game. I really enjoy it, but it's got a very loose rule structure. And some players just find it too loose. There's too much GM fiat, there's too much player decision into what happens. They want something more structured with a set of rules where they can actually look at the rules. And this is the great thing about Ars Magica in some ways, is it provides a very detailed, defined framework of rules.
Yes.
And you can always ask if you're unsure on the forums, etc., and find out how the rules are supposed to work. But because the rules are so detailed, it's a very structured game. It's much closer in feel to AD&D than many of the new RPGs which come out for Forge, etc. But, okay, let's go back to... So I then played a game in the 90s, which was quite popular, and I ran a campaign... And it was about a group of magi living in East Anglia, and they were living in the Fens. And that proved to be such a success that from 1999, I have never got a month when I have not been running Ars Magica, despite the fact I've run maybe 20 or 30 other RPGs all at the same time. You know, I've always, and I think I've had a weekly campaign going for pretty much all of the last decade. At the moment, I have 3 sagas a week I play, but maybe that's just me.
That's just you.
That's just you. That's just me. Most people don't have the time to do it, I guess. But, of course, when you're writing for Ars Magica, you can always argue that, no, dear, I shouldn't really go and get a job, because I really should concentrate on working harder on getting this... No, I'm joking. But, you know, you do... When you've got spare time, and if you work hard during the day, it's quite nice in the evenings to get a game going. So, Tom, how did you finally come back to Ars Magica? What brought you back into playing Ars Magica after the 10-player experience?
Well, a friend of mine bought a copy of 5th edition, and our little game group was going, right, what should we play now? We'll play Ars Magica. We all got very excited about writing characters up. We took a while getting characters done. Then we played a little bit. And then we stopped again. and then I got a job down in the same town where you live. And so here I was going, yeah, so I've got the Ars Magica main book and one supplement for it. I'm quite interested in it, but, you know, I've only played short games. I'd really like to play a long game. And that was eventually how we started up.
Yeah, and we started the campaign, and I think, did we play a few mini adventures or sagas before you? Or did you actually... No, I think you actually said, let's play, and we've been playing in the same saga ever since.
Yes.
Now, I came back to ours, and as I said, one of the things that actually possibly would help a lot of people now is the thing that put me off was the stats running off -5 to +5, plus your dice roll, you know. I mean, I was used to 3 to 18 stats. And it's amazing just how liberating... I mean, once you got to White Wolf games with 5 dots,
yeah.
You know, how many dots have you got in
yeah.
whatever, I can't remember the name, strength.
Yeah.
That's a stat that most games have.
Yeah.
I played a few White Wolf games. I've had the original Vampire when it first came out, first aired, but never run it. And I think I've owned every edition of Vampire, but never run any of them. But I mean, I've got my head around the dice system for that, and I ran Changeling for a long time, and I ran a few things. But it was the stat system that really put me off. But once I got the magic system, which is going to be a completely different podcast because it's just too awesome to do justice to in our remaining 4 minutes. So once I got the actual magic system and got worked out how it worked, verb plus noun, and I realised that my character could improvise spells, make up spells as they went, and do almost anything. But there was there's a rule system. There's actually rules. There are limits, and that's what makes it great.
Yeah.
Because in a pure story game, which is really story driven, where you have incredible levels of power, there aren't any hard limits, and I find that frustrating actually.
And to be fair, by comparison to another game of also of similar origins, Mage, the classic Mage of the Ascension. With a few spheres, with a few rotations from 1 to 5 in, there it's incredibly broad strokes.
Yeah.
Whereas with Ars 4 and
there's
Ars
a vast bit, difference between level 4 and level 5 dots.
Levels,
And I mean, also a lot of that came down to hand waving. And I think in second edition that was close, that was more the case. You know, a spell to heal somebody of a medium wound was roughly level 20, you know, or level 15, or whatever. But it was the referee chose. Whereas now there are hard rules that give you. It would make a great computer game. The problem is that the degree of complexity that the magic system offers is so vast, so overwhelming, and so incredibly liberating, you just wouldn't know how to start programming it. I mean,
that's one of the things which got me when I came back to Ars. Ars 5th, you open up this lovely big rule book, you go through the first few chapters and go, oh, the background looks good. Oh, the template characters, they look fun. Virtues and flaws. What a great way about going with your character. This really adds flavour, and bits about your covenant, bits about magic, and then you come to the huge vast spell lists, and you get bogged down. But once you get your head around one particular area of magic, and work out how to play a mage of that sort, you get into
it. Well, once you actually understand that, you can do anything. Yeah. And as I say, we'll have to talk about the magic next week, but I think we need to draw this to a close. So what I'm going to say is, at the moment, if you've never considered playing Ars Magica, it's a game about wizards, it's set in medieval Europe, the possibilities are almost endless to change history, to change the world, and to play an important, powerful character. Different people can take part as referee, and the character and the whole troop, the group of players, all take part of the duty in keeping control of the game and the direction of the game and the way the story's going, but there's only one referee in a classic adventure who writes an adventure and runs it in a classic RPG style. So it's a classic RPG where the referee changes and where players play different characters in different sessions and then come back to their mage who they haven't played for a year or two later. So I think we're going to stop now, but we've spent 30 seconds planning this concept, Arcane
Connection.
I remember the name of the podcast. I was thinking about calling it Odin's Halfling. Can you work out why? Odin's Hobbit. Well, we're both half Danish. But anyway, but here we are. So this was Arcane Connection number one, talking about why we love Ars Magica and why should you play it. Give it a go. This probably hasn't convinced anyone, but we'd love to hear your comments. And 30 seconds in the planning, £3 in the production, and 30 minutes in the recording.
So, however, if it's not put you off, Don't worry, this has only been the worst podcast ever. Next week, we can have the second worst podcast as we get moving.
Probably, yeah, that's true. We were improved. We were improved. So, probably the worst podcast in the world, brewed in the UK by Danes. I'm CJ, this is Tom, signing off. Bye.